Good morning and welcome to the morning session of the Tuesday, December 7th, 2021 Court of Appeals session. I'm Rico Bishop and I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Frankie Moore on my right and Judge Dave Arterburn on my left. We have three cases scheduled for today. The second case will be heard by WebEx by both parties, I understand. I would just remind everyone that if you have any sensitive matters, just remember that you want to talk about, just remember that we are being live streamed and recorded. So keep that in mind. So when I will say the case name and you counsel may approach, and then I'll repeat it again as we're ready to get started. Please state your name and who you represent when you come up to present your argument. All right, thank you. So our first case this morning is State versus McAuliffe. Again, this is State versus McAuliffe. You may proceed.
Morning. May it please the court.
Morning. Good morning.
My name is Matt Striggins, along with Tom Striggins in Sarpy County PD's office. I represent the appellant, David McAuliffe, in this matter. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 1 minute of time for rebuttal. Your Honors, we're here today because the court erred in denying Mr. McAuliffe's motion to discharge for violating his constitutional speedy trial rights. There are two issues in this case. First is whether a person can ever waive his constitutional speedy trial rights. The answer to this question is no. The second is whether Mr. McAuliffe's constitutional speedy trial rights were violated. The answer to this question is yes.
I'm just going to start right off on the waiver issue, and I realize you didn't appeal the statutory issue. But do you disagree that with regard to the statutory procedure, there was a waiver?
We're not arguing or contesting the statutory waiver on the appeal, no.
So, but does that fact, the fact of the waiver, does that relate to the factor under the constitutional analysis relating to the delay involved in the case?
You know, I think that it plays some role, but more generally, you know, the prong for the length of delay, I think, is going to take into account other periods of delay as well. Specifically, what I want to talk about is there was an 82 day period where Mr. McAuliffe was incarcerated prior to the filing of the information, and I think that also certainly matters for the period of his arrest. So there's 356 days between the filing of the information and the motion to discharge, and he was actually incarcerated for 438 days when you take into account the fact that he was arrested on or about November 25th, 2019. So I want to talk a little bit about the rest of those factors, because when you look at all four factors under the Barker v. Wingo test, I think all four of them fall in Mr. McAuliffe's favor. I've talked a little bit about the length of the delay. And I want to talk also about the fact that when you account for the speedy trial calculation, 59% of the delay was attributable to the state's delay for failing, if you include the fact that they had failed to file the information for 82 days. So only 177 days were attributable to the defendant's motions, and the remainder of those days were attributable to the state. I also want to point out that Mr. McAuliffe asserted his right to speedy trial several times after his statutory right had been waived. He doesn't have a duty to bring himself or demand a trial per State v. Robinson, but he continued to assert his right at every opportunity. He asserted his right to speedy trial at the September 2nd hearing, at the December 9th hearing, and then, of course, again, in the January 31st motion to discharge. His objections to the state's request to continuances at both of those hearings were noted by the court. And, you know, I think in this case, the prejudice to the defendant is very evident on the face of the record, given the fact that he'd been incarcerated for 438 days. And also the amount of time, the period of time in which he was incarcerated came at the beginning and during the worst months of the pandemic. So this was a very specific source of anxiety for him, such that it was even noted on the record in the BOE by the trial court and by his own trial counsel.
Did I hear you say that only 177 days were attributed to the defendant?
That's right, Your Honor.
Did the trial court find something like 277 days attributable?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the trial court's opinion from April 8th doubled up on the period of time from June 12th to the filing of the motion to discharge, which added an additional period of time that there was some overlap there. And I think that was the source of the confusion, which is why the majority of the delay is actually the fault of the state and not the defendant.
Thank you.
I'd like to return to talk a little bit about the reasons for the delay as well, because the reasons for the delay at the September 2nd and December 10th continuances were because the state had twice failed to secure material witnesses for trial. The primary burden to ensure the cases are brought to trial rests with the state and the courts, as recognized by this court in State v. Schmader. There was also a periods of delay that were that were the fault of the court itself. The court continued a July 20th hearing to July 22nd on its own motion, and also continued the December 7th motion to December 9th on its own motion. So significant periods of delay were not attributable to the defendant. And I want to point to State v. Schmader as well. So in this court recognized in that case that the defendant had been incarcerated for 600 days, and 502 days of the delay in that case was attributable to the defendant. However, this court held that the length of delay was such a long period of time that factor still fell in favor of the defendant. Here, 438 days is attributable, was the length of delay, and the majority of it is the fault of the state. So we believe for those reasons that those are the two factors that that they fall in Mr. McCall's favor.
Since you're arguing those other factors, are you conceding that there's been no presumptively prejudicial delay in terms of length of delay?
I think the prejudice is evident on its face, just given the sheer amount of time.
You're arguing prejudice, but is it presumptively prejudicial as set forth in State versus Short?
I don't think it's presumptively, no. But given the length of time, as well as the fact that the record at multiple points reflects his incarceration during the entire duration of that delay, I think that is the prejudice is evident to the defendant. I'd also like to point out that, you know, when analyzing the prejudice prong, this court mentioned in State v. Schmader that it must be looked at in light of the three interests that prong seeks to protect, which is the, you know, preventing oppressive and pretrial incarceration, which I've talked about at length, and then also minimizing anxiety and concern of the accused.
What evidence was there of anxiety, of specific anxiety or concern by the defendant that was presented at the hearing?
Well, so at every opportunity before the court, the defendant asserted his speedy trial rights and made sure to object to the state's continuances. At the December 9th hearing, he specifically said that he did not want the time from that continuance taxed against his speedy trial time.
That goes to assertion of the right, doesn't it? Not to prejudice.
Yes, it does. But he was very clearly it was very clearly a source of concern for him. It was also a source of concern for the
court. And what was the evidence that showed that it was a source of concern? Evidence did you adduce?
In the December 9th hearing, his own trial counsel, as well as the state, mentioned that the COVID-19 pandemic was an issue for the courts, and he was the one that was incarcerated at the time.
That came from counsel, though, so that's not evidence, right?
No, Your Honor, that's right. So for those reasons, we believe that that this factor also weighs in Mr. McCall's favor. If there are no further questions, I'll preserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Defendant argues that the district court erred when it denied his motion of discharge on constitutional speedy trial grounds. The state obviously disagrees. I need to correct some calculations in my brief, but first I want to point out how bare bones the defendant's brief is on appeal. According to the Nebraska Supreme Court, an appellant's brief cannot contain conclusory assertions unsupported by a coherent analytical argument and still comply with the requirement that a party must both specifically assign and argue an alleged error in his or her brief. For example, in his brief, the defendant claims that the time for the state's continuances was, quote, unreasonable, end quote, and the continuances were, quote, not substantially supported by any evidence or specific reasoning, end quote. Those are conclusory assertions without any analytical argument to support them, and they should not be enough to comply with the rule. There are no facts in the appellant's brief even telling us what the continuances were even about. I think if this court wanted to, it could affirm on that basis alone. Nevertheless, in preparing for today, I realized that there are some calculations in my brief that I need to correct. First, I realized, and this could blow this all up, is that there is no waiver, as the district court found and as I argued in my brief. That's because Monday, September 7th, 2020 was Labor Day. So the last day that the state would have had to bring the defendant to trial as of the date that he filed his motion to continue was Tuesday, September 8th, and not the 7th. The court rescheduled the trial for September 8th when it granted the defendant's motion to continue. So accordingly, the defendant's continuance did not extend the trial date beyond the 6 month speedy trial period. So there was no waiver under subsection 4B of the speedy trial.
So there's been no statutory waiver here.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I apologize for the miscalculation in my brief. I should have caught that. You see Monday, September 7th. Second, I failed to account for the 7 days of overlap on the defendant's motion to continue in his plea and abatement. That was from September 1st to September 8th. So assuming the time due to both of the state's continuances is excluded, there are 261 excludable days like the district court found, and I'm not including the days that it added for the motion for discharge, and not 268, like I said in my brief. But nevertheless, the defendant's motion would still be premature. Also, because I failed to count for the 7 days, the state does actually need time from one of its continuances, and we think that we get that time from the state's second motion to continue. The court granted that motion under subsections 4CI, 4F, and 4B. Obviously, as I stated, I think 4B was erroneous finding because there was no waiver. The prosecutor initially requested the second continuance because its witness, Jessica Martinez, was unavailable for the December 15th trial. Martinez is endorsed as a witness on the second amended information, which is the most recent charging document. The prosecutor stated in her own affidavit, which was introduced into evidence, that Martinez was a material witness for the state. We know from the record that this is a child sexual assault case, and Martinez's own affidavit states that she works at Project Harmony. Presumably, she interviewed or was involved in the interview of the alleged victim then, or victims. The prosecutor served Martinez with a subpoena to testify at the December 15th trial, but as Martinez stated in her affidavit, she was on maternity leave then and would return to active duty on February 15th of 2021. Based on these facts, the state submits that the three requirements of 4CI were met, and the court properly excluded that time under that subsection. If this court should disagree, then the same time is excludable under 4F for good cause due to the pandemic. That was the state's other reason for the continuance, which it made clear at the hearing on its motion. The court determined that it could not safely hold a jury trial in December 2020 due to the number of prospective jurors and the number of witnesses in this case, which was the state had endorsed 44 some witnesses on the second amended information. Exhibit 5 contains the compilation of COVID-19 materials that the state introduced into evidence. The defendant has never contested that evidence, and the evidence is substantially similar to that introduced in the recent cases where the Nebraska Supreme Court has upheld excluding periods under 4F for good cause due to the pandemic. Accordingly, the court properly excluded the time under 4F in the speedy trial statute. That was all a long way of arguing that the length of delay does not weigh in favor of the defendant. It weighs in the state's favor. The reason for delay does not favor him either, since the bulk of the delay was due to his own motions and the pandemic. The state concedes the defendant asserted his right. And as for prejudice, in his brief, he made no argument that he suffered from any of the three identified interests for the prejudice factor. He can't expand on that today. It's not in his brief. In short, the state believes the district court did not err when it denied the defendant's motion for discharge on constitutional speedy trial grounds. And if there are no further questions, We ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, I do have a question.
Sure.
The argument was made about 82 days that were pre-information. Do you have, what's your argument with regard to those 82 days?
That's pre-indictment delay and not what we're here for. We're here on a Sixth Amendment constitutional speedy trial argument, not a Fifth Amendment pre-indictment delayed argument.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And how much time does appellant have for rebuttal?
1 minute and 8 seconds, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Unless there are any questions, I'd like to start by returning to the issue of the pre-indictment delay. So while the pre-indictment delay doesn't factor into the statutory speedy trial calculation for purposes under 29-1207, it certainly still matters for a period of a constitutional argument under the Sixth Amendment and Section 11 of the Nebraska Constitution in terms of analyzing the length of delay prong for a speedy trial violation. So that's why I still want to emphasize the importance of that.
And did you cite to case law supporting this argument?
Well, Your Honor, there's no specific case law on point in Nebraska law, but there are, when you look to cases like State v. Schmader, where there are cases where the length of delay is 600 days. Fact of the matter is Mr. McCullough has still been in prison for 438 days. Regardless of what point the state filed the information. The next thing that I'd like to talk about is the state had some concerns about some conclusory assertions from the brief. I just want to point out and say that I think the prejudice of the defendant in this case is evident, given the fact that he's been incarcerated for the length of time that he has.
Does that take us back to presumptive prejudice?
No, Your Honor, we're still not arguing presumptive prejudice.
Okay. It sounds like presumptive prejudice to me. If there's no evidence to support it, I don't see any argument in the brief about the pre-indictment delay. It seems like we're back to presumptive prejudice.
Well, if there are no further questions, Your Honor, I just want to emphasize and that the four factors do fall in favor of the appellant's favor here. And so I request that the an absolute discharge of the information is brought against him and ask this court to overrule the trial court's motion to discharge. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted.